Hi, it's me, Katya, EP of On The Media. So over the last couple of weeks, we've been in your ears asking for help to support the show. You've heard from Brooke, you've heard from Micah, now it's my turn. As the manager of this outfit, I am not going to dress it up for you. I'm going to tell you how it is. If every single one of you, every single one of our listeners, gave $1 to the show right now, we'd have enough to cover the budget for a couple of years. But that's just not a realistic goal. What is a realistic goal is getting the 2% of you who donate up to 3%. It's just 1% difference. Maybe you're listening to me now and you're thinking, oh, I'll get to it later. Or it's just too complicated to make a donation. Or even someone else will do it. Well, here's what I have to say to you. Don't put it off. Do it now. It's super easy at our website. It's literally one click. Do you expect someone else to pay for your New York Times subscription? Or your Netflix account? No, right? So it's time to pay for On The Media. We're counting on you guys. Thanks.
The Village Voice is no more.
After more than four decades in print, the city paper is shutting down.
A weekly connection to Twin Cities culture, now just a 41-year chapter in its journalistic history.
What happened to the offbeat, irreverent alt-weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country? From WNYC in New York, this is On The Media. I'm Michael Loewinger. On this week's show, an ode to the Village Voice.
The Voice was your guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
Plus, the founder of an infamous chain of alt-weeklies finds himself in hot water over his Craigslist competitor.
We started in 2004 Backpage because we knew that the classified business was going away.
Backpage.com seems to have knowingly allowed women and children to be exploited.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On The Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Michael Loewinger. Alternative weeklies, alt-weeklies, are the type of offbeat, fearless publication that once upon a time you could pick up on a street corner, in a bar or cafe, in cities across the country. Over the course of roughly 60 years, they transformed journalism. Today, they're nearly extinct.
Well, it is the end of an era. This week is your last chance to grab this, the current issue of the Baltimore City Paper.
The Village Voice is no more. The Pulitzer Prize-winning paper was known for its coverage of politics, music, theater, and the gay community.
A weekly connection to Twin Cities culture, now just a 41-year chapter in its journalistic history.
Tomorrow's edition of the San Francisco Bay Guardian is going to be the last.
The Boston Phoenix, Urban Tulsa, Philadelphia City Paper, San Francisco Bay Guardian, and Knoxville Mercury have also closed shop. They aren't totally gone. The Association of Alternative News Media lists 101 members, but those that survive must contend with constant mergers, buyouts, and financial precarity. The legacy of alt-weeklies, however, lives on in a generation of astounding writers, including, but in no way limited to, Wayne Barrett, Joe Klein, Catherine Boo, Ta-Nehisi Coates, David Carr, Susan Orlean, Jonathan Gold, Colson Whitehead, Ann Powers, Anil Dash, and on and on. They went after local politicians, championed weirdo artists, and challenged the status quo, including the conventions of journalism and writing. For the next hour, we'll celebrate the guts and glory of a bygone media era, beginning with a look back at where it all began, in Greenwich Village. In 1955, Norman Mailer took the money he'd earned from his bestseller, The Naked and the Dead, and together with Dan Wolfe, a psychologist, and publisher Ed Fancher, founded The Village Voice.
They wanted to create a paper that reflected the Greenwich Village that they knew and loved, beatnik culture and jazz and writers like James Baldwin.
Tricia Romano worked at The Voice in the 90s and 2000s. She's the author of a new oral history titled The Freaks Came Out to Write, the definitive history of The Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. She explains that at the outset, editor Dan Wolfe had a preference for hiring amateurs. As he put it, quote, "It was a philosophical position. We wanted to jam the gears of creeping automatism."
Journalism at that time was very much who, what, where, why, when. It's almost like constructing a puzzle piece rather than it is writing lyrically in any way. So he and Norman Mailer also leaned towards writers writing. And they knew that if you loved something and you were passionate about a subject, you were going to bring that passion to the voice in a way that an objective newspaper reporter really wasn't even allowed to.
Give me a couple examples of people who fit in at the Village Voice, helped define its style, but probably wouldn't have gotten hired at one of its competitors.
You've got Jules Feiffer, who was the Pulitzer-winning cartoonist who wrote these satirical, very adult comics about relationships between men and women called Sick, Sick, Sick. He got paid nothing for many years. And then Jonas Mikas, a Lithuanian refugee who was an avant-garde filmmaker and director and hosted loft parties and showed Andy Warhol films. He walked in one day and says, "How come you don't have any columns on cinema?" And they said, "I don't know. Why don't you do it?" So he started doing that. And then, you know, you had Richard Goldstein that comes along later, and he is the first rock critic by many people's calculations. And he is actually one of the few people who actually did go to journalism school, which he tried to hide.
Because it seemed like a square?
Yeah. Well, you know, he was the weirdo at his journalism school. He had long hair, and he tells a joke how to mess with the instructors, he would put a sugar cube on his desk.
Because they would think it was acid.
Yes. He was embedded in the early rock scene and hanging out with Warhol and the Velvet Underground and all those people. And he quickly became very well known for this because that music was just starting to explode.
From December 1962 to March 1963, seven major daily newspapers in New York went on strike.
No news is bad news to 8 million New Yorkers when strikes close down their daily papers.
The Voice didn't, and since it was available on newsstands, it kind of like stood out to New Yorkers outside of Greenwich Village for the first time, leading to a spike in its circulation from about 28,000 to 35,000.
That audience discovers, oh, they're covering stuff that I go to or I'd like to go to, and I don't read about it anywhere else. And so we suddenly got more advertising and a greater audience from that. It just grew from there.
The paper was, roughly speaking, divided into the front of the book, which was the news coverage, and the back of the book, which was more arts and culture. One of the early news reporters is this amazing woman, Mary Perot Nichols, who started at the paper in 1958. Her origin story at the paper, it turns out, is not that unusual. She kind of just like walked in through the front door, right?
Yeah. That's what a lot of people did. They just would walk into the office. They would just come in and be like, "Hey, do you know about this thing? Or why aren't you covering this or that?" And she was a mother who lived nearby, and her and a group of other mothers would hang out in Washington Square Park, one of them being Jane Jacobs. This is the time when Robert Moses had this vision for the city that was much more car-centric and would have bulldozed the lower part of Manhattan as we know it now. And she began going into the Voice and saying, "Why aren't you covering this?" After a few tries, they said, "Why don't you do it?" And she had literally no reporting skills and had never done that before. But she apparently loved the research and she loved the hunt.
Robert Moses, of course, was an incredibly powerful urban planner in New York City for decades. What happened to his attempt to turn the beloved Washington Square Park into just another thoroughfare?
Well, a lot of what Mary did was advocate against it every week in the Village Voice and getting the neighbors involved, getting especially a lot of the women who were using that park every day with their kids to block it. And eventually, politically, she was able to convince a lot of the mafia store owners also she would put it to them like, look, you know, all those people that pay tribute to you, meaning all the people that got money from, they're not going to be there anymore. Like, none of those stores will be there. That restaurant won't be there. So you're going to lose money.
The offices of the Village Voice were right next to the Stonewall Inn. Voice reporters were there in 1969 and covered when the bar was raided in an event that sparked the modern-day gay rights movement. How did the Voice cover the Stonewall Uprising, and why were they targeted by the gay rights movement in the so-called Zaps?
So back in the day, gay bars were not allowed. Also, I should say, most of the gay bars, if not all of them, were owned by the mafia. So it was sort of this game that the police and the mafia would play, which was they'd go raid the gay bar, and the mafia would pay off the police, and then the bar would reopen. But in this case, they were raided, and the patrons were fed up. And they started getting kind of roughly handled by the police outside. Howard Smith went inside. He was kind of like a nightlife reporter on the scene in the 60s and 70s. He was inside with the police and Lucian Truscott, who wrote from the outside. And, you know, they are both straight white men. And the way they covered it was both with more seriousness and length than you would see in any other publication. There were two, probably 1,200 word something articles inside the paper, whereas any other paper, I think, maybe ran a little squib and no one was there. But they used words that we would find offensive today.
The headline was Forces of, and then the F slur. That's offensive today, but it was offensive then too. And gay readers of the news coverage were not happy with it.
They were not happy with that, and they were also not happy with the fact that The Voice wouldn't take ads that said the word gay. So they were zapped, meaning like protested. And The Voice's offices were pretty transparent. The windows, I think, were showing to the street, and they just sort of disrupted the meetings and such long enough that Dan Wolf, the editor-in-chief, was like, okay, I guess we got to deal with this. That was a learning lesson for The Voice, and it happened much sooner than it did for other media.
And one of the sort of internal agitators at The Voice, who was quite critical of the homophobic language that was used in its coverage of Stonewall, was Richard Goldstein, who you've already mentioned. He was arguably the paper and America's first real rock critic. He was a gay man who helped shape the music writing of the paper. In addition to Goldstein, there was Robert Christgau, who joined in the late 1960s as a rock critic and columnist. And he went on to be the paper's longtime music editor. He jokingly referred to himself as the, quote, Dean of American Rock Critics, which would be this kind of nickname that would follow him around for the rest of his career. These guys hung out around the Village, including the iconic bar and venue CBGB, where they hung out with, you know, Lou Reed and Patti Smith and saw early shows of Blondie and the Ramones.
CBGB was not very far away from The Voice's office, and it was where you went to see local bands, great new music. And those bands just happened to be legendary, or they would become legendary, in part because The Voice was shining a light on them. They weren't the only one, but they were certainly the local outlet to do that.
Robert Christgau would later become known for his consumer guides, where he gave new albums a letter grade, like, you know, A, B, or C, or whatever. And as one of the men you quote in the book describes it, Christgau was hated by bands. There's a famous live performance of Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed from 1978. He's kind of vamping while playing the song, and he says this about Robert Christgau.
Imagine working for you and you got a B plus on the ass of the Village Voice. And you don't gotta take this shit.
I've never heard the whole thing. That's amazing. You know, the thing about Bob, which is different than a lot of music writers, is that he did not want to be friends or friendly with the bands because his gruff exterior belies a very soft interior. And if he liked somebody as a person and then hated the record or had to be critical of it, he felt bad. And so he found it easier to be just completely apart from the band.
Coming up, multiple ownership changes herald the beginning of the end for the Village Voice. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Michael Lowinger. We left off our story about the history of the Village Voice at the end of its early heyday of the 50s and 60s. In 1977, after passing through several different owners, the Voice was acquired, to the great chagrin of its writers, by media mogul Rupert Murdoch. The staff ended up unionizing and scoring some surprisingly progressive wins. Here's Tricia Romano.
The Voice was part of a package. It was New York Magazine and the Village Voice. And Rupert Murdoch didn't really want the Village Voice. He wanted New York Magazine. But come to find out, New York Magazine is actually not the moneymaker the Voice is. So when he took over, the New York Magazine staff was fired. And the Voice staff freaked out and formed this union. After a few years, they're talking about healthcare at a meeting, union meeting, and we had a thing where if you had a live-in partner, they could be on your healthcare.
Somebody that you're dating but who you're not married to.
Yes. That was a big thing in their negotiations, to get spousal benefits for unmarried couples and extend that to gay couples. And they got it. Murdoch was like, can we not trumpet this? And the lawyer was like, oh, no, but they are going to trumpet this. They're going to trumpet it specifically.
You mentioned that Rupert Murdoch saw that the Village Voice was more of a moneymaker than New York Magazine. How did the paper make real money?
The classified ads in the back of the paper were basically a form of printing money. That was a source of income for decades for the Voice. And for a long time, people would line up at Astor Place on Tuesday night, waiting in line to get the first edition of the paper so they could get a jump on apartment ads.
Yes, there was this quote from Jackie Rudin in your book, who worked in advertising, who said, quote,
people found their lives through the Village Voice, whether it was a partner or a job or an apartment or whatever.
Blondie and Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band found their drummers through classified ads in the Village Voice.
You know, Max Weinberg was like, the Village Voice changed my life.
Who was auditioning to be Bruce Springsteen's drummer.
That's where you would post. There's no Craigslist. There's no Facebook Marketplace, no Twitter. There's nothing like that. That's where you would post your Help Wanted ads. And musicians did the same thing as some office looking for a secretary.
Your book outlines this kind of rift at the paper between the mostly white male reporters who covered the news for the front of the book, the so-called white boys, as they were known, and the feminist and gay writers who mostly covered arts and culture in the back of the book. You write about this really interesting episode in 1986 when Robert Friedman, the editor of the paper, made the call to put performance artist Karen Finley on the cover of the paper.
The article was written by Cynthia Carr, who went by C. Carr. And she had had a column about performance art for several years. And she came to Richard Goldstein and her editor, Karen Durbin, and said, there's this performance artist I really want to cover. She's pretty controversial. I think you should come see her. And the thing that she was known for was using food. She would often be naked or partially naked or wear like little prom dresses, and she would crush canned yams on her body while she sort of had this incantation, kind of possessing the male voice. Cynthia Carr writes this story, and they decide to put it on the cover. And she was just posing with her dog. It's a very pretty cover shot. But you have to realize back then, papers are finite and space is finite. And so what gets on the cover is a big thing. It's a big deal. And at the time, Pete Hamill, who's one of the famous columnists in New York journalism, worked at Daily News, and he was like a star. And he sort of led this charge against this piece because he saw it as unworthy of being on the cover because it wasn't real journalism in his his eyes, and it diminished the hard news that all the guys in the front of the book did. He never even saw the work, but he wrote like a full page denouncing the story and the work and the idea of the art that she was doing.
It was really, I mean, obscenity seemed like kind of deliberate in this performance. Do you want to describe what she was doing with the yams?
It was sexually explicit and meant to be provocative. And it was a commentary on the male gaze and objectification of women, etc. And, you know, it's just the kind of thing that those guys, it just is going to go over their heads. So they led this charge. It was him, Nat Hentoff, Barrett, Newfield.
These are like some of the heavy hitter investigative reporters.
All these guys were like titans at the paper by this time. And they go marching in and say, how can you put this filth on the front? And not really understanding that their city was very different from a city that Cynthia Carr was in. But the voice was a reflection of the moment that New York was in. So the front of the book left graffiti in the office, in the bathroom. They left cans of yams everywhere on desks and around the cubicles. And it was childish. And the more upset the back of the book got, the more the front of the book would push it, vice versa. It's interesting to note that the front of the book wasn't as big, I mean, literally space-wise, as the back of the book. The back of the book was all the listings and the film reviews and the music and the theater and art and dance, all of it. It just didn't make the cover as often. Cynthia Carr was like, if it hadn't made the cover, I don't even know if they would have realized it was in the paper. But because it was on the cover, they were furious.
You're describing this tension at the paper, and reading the book, it felt to me like there was this sort of constant hum of struggle, where on one hand you have the Village Voice as this very radical, very progressive paper, and yet we keep seeing moments where it's kind of failing to live up to its own values. On one hand, the paper's celebrating great Black music, and on the other hand, there were very few people of color writing for the paper in its first couple decades. The paper was among the first to write about abortion. It had this great stable of feminist writers like Ellen Willis, Laurie Stone, Karen Durbin, and M. Mark, and yet, internally, they faced derision from their own colleagues. The paper had these pioneering gay writers, even as the Village Voice is publishing homophobic slurs in its coverage of the Stonewall Uprising.
You know, it was a constant learning process, I think, for the people on the paper and the people reading it, right? And the fact that they didn't really have any Black writers until Stanley Crouch shows up is crazy. I think it was 1976 or something.
Basically 20 years in.
Yeah. They wrote about Black causes. Wayne Barrett, the reporter that covered Trump and Giuliani, and Jack Newfield, who wrote about worst landlords and the worst judges, and Nat Hentoff, who got his start writing about jazz. They were all very much about civil rights and were a big part of that movement. But they were sort of blind to the fact that there were really no Black people at the paper. And no one seemed to figure that out. And so Schneiderman, David Schneiderman, who was an op-ed editor at the New York Times in the 70s, comes on board and he's the editor-in-chief. And he says, what? This is the Progressive Village Voice and there are no Black people on staff? And then they also got investigated by a government agency for this. So they had to take action. And right around that time is when hip-hop is sort of born. And hip-hop helped usher in a whole bunch of Black writers into the paper. Carol Cooper, Barry Michael Cooper, not related. They're covering hip-hop. Later, Barry Michael Cooper becomes more of an investigative reporter and covers the crack epidemic and does the story that is New Jack City that becomes the movie. Hilton Owls joins the paper. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning critic now at The New Yorker. But for decades, there was nothing. And it still was a very, quote-unquote, white paper, even towards its end.
I'm going to jump way ahead to the 2000s. when we're starting to see cracks in the Village Voice, its business model. Anil Dash, now a famous technologist and writer, joined the Village Voice in 2001. And this is when Craigslist, the classified ads website, was first becoming a thing. And then 9/11 happens. How did the internet and 9/11 converge to ruin the Village Voice's whole business model?
So Anil gets to The Voice in the summer of 2001, and it happens to be the summer that Craigslist is about to hard launch in New York. And he came from San Francisco, and he knew what was coming. And he's telling them, you guys, we're about to get disrupted in a major way. And people ignored this.
So like the second workday, my third day there, Craigslist launched in New York. And I'm just talking to somebody. I'm like, hey, what are we doing about Craigslist? And it was like, who's Craig? What are you talking about? And I couldn't articulate why it mattered so much. Like, I couldn't tell people, like, a whole world is about to change. I felt like Chicken Little. You know what I mean? Like, I kept running around being like, the internet is coming. I mean, it was just that, because it sounds crazy, right? Like, you sound like a crazy person.
But then 9/11 happens, and Google News wasn't a thing yet. But people wanted immediate information at that point. That's when people started pushing out news a lot faster online. So the combination of those two things starts to render print not necessarily useless, but slow. When 9/11 happens, there's a little bit of a recession, and the apartment ads stop being placed with the same level and the same numbers that they were before. And then you have Craigslist saying, hey, you don't need to mail in or call anyone or fax your listing to some number. You can just post it directly online and it's free. And so a lot of people just shifted to that. And the apartment ads never recovered after that.
In 2005, Village Voice Media, which at this point was owned by a financial management group along with six other alt-weeklies, merged with the New Times, a newspaper chain. They became the biggest company of alt-weeklies with 17 papers. The New Times had long coveted the Village Voice, but once it bought Village Voice Media, it started picking it apart limb by limb.
It was sort of like they just wanted the logo and the name, but that logo and name only has value because of what was there when you bought it, this collection of voices that made it the Village Voice. And those voices changed. Some people came and went, but there's a core sensibility that they just didn't get.
In 2017, the print paper for The Voice was shut down. And a year later, it seemed like the digital version was dead too, until 2020, when it was revived by a new crop of ownership. I think we can confidently say that the Village Voice of old is gone. What's the latest iteration like?
It's a zombie. The Voice, to my knowledge, only has one employee, and that's R.C. Baker, who is essentially the editor, and they run some freelance pieces. So it's just is sort of there. But it's not present in the city the way it should be. The Voice was your guide to a specific kind of life in New York City at its specific times. That collection of knowledge from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper, that's gone.
Tricia Romano is the author of the new book, The Freaks Came Out to Write. Tricia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the story of one foul-mouthed editor and his empire of muckraking dirtbags. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Michael Loewinger. As we just heard, the Village Voice was bought by a national chain of alt-weeklies called the New Times, owned by a man named Michael Lacey. Over four decades, Lacey and his business partner, James Larkin, built the largest, most influential company in alternative media. And when Craigslist came along, Lacey and Larkin launched their own classified website to head off the same disaster that was taking down newspapers left and right. Backpage, as it was called, soon became synonymous with sex and scandal. The Justice Department was paying attention, and in 2018...
the government cracked down on sex trafficking. Federal agents this afternoon seized the classified ad website Backpage.com and closed it down.
Seven people were arrested, including the site's founders. Tonight, they are facing federal charges, including prostitution and money laundering.
Lacey, now 75 years old, has already been tried twice. The first was declared a mistrial, and the second, last fall, found him guilty of one count of money laundering. The other 84 counts were dropped. He now faces a third trial this summer. A new podcast series from Audible called Hold Fast documents how Mike Lacey, in his own telling, became the Larry Flint of the internet age. The hosts, three former New Times journalists, conducted a series of interviews with their former boss to tell the story of the rise and fall of Backpage.com. What follows is an excerpted version of episode one. Sam Eifling kicks it off, then you'll hear from Trevor Aronson, followed by Michael Mooney.
Lacey is in his mid-70s, light blue eyes, a nose that looks like it's caught more than a few punches. He wears designer, black, thick-rimmed glasses, and sports tattoos on his hands. He looks like a magazine editor sharing a body with a barroom brawler. And actually, that's sort of what he is. If he ever charms you into forgetting his brawling half, just read his knuckles. Tattooed across the business part of his fists, in faded blue ink, are the letters H-O-L-D-F-A-S-T. Hold fast. It's a traditional seafarer's tattoo. Hold fast tells other sailors that you can grip a rope through any storm. It tells them they can put their life in your hands, that you'll never let go.
Lacey's newspaper career began on the campus of Arizona State University, where he and other students founded an anti-Vietnam War paper in 1970. They called this new paper Phoenix New Times. For the first edition of the paper, Lacey covered a Vietnam War protest. A number of construction workers had shown up as counter-protesters.
I'm sitting up there with the construction workers.
This is Michael Lacey.
And this guy, I'm interviewing him, and he says, "Excuse me, I'll be right back."
The guy walked down the field and up to a man who'd organized the demonstration.
And he hauls off, sucker punches him, knocks all his teeth out, and drops him like a sack of potatoes, unconscious. And then the guy walks back up to finish the interview with me. And I'm thinking, well, that's more je ne sais quoi than I've ever seen in my entire life. My God. And that was our first story in the first issue of it was the New Times. So that was the beginning.
Jim Larkin joined the paper 2 years later and ran the business side, as New Times built a reputation for aggressive, renegade journalism. From that one newspaper in Phoenix, Lacey and Larkin bought up papers until they had the largest chain in the history of alternative journalism, spanning the nation. From LA Weekly in Los Angeles to The Village Voice in New York, from Seattle Weekly to Miami New Times. At its height, Lacey's newspaper chain generated close to $200 million in annual revenue. Alternative weekly papers, or alt weeklies, as they're often called, were usually free and distributed at bars, restaurants, and on street corners. They varied in style, but there was a general template. A provocative cover, news coverage up front, a long narrative feature, food and arts coverage in the middle, a robust music section, and finally, in the back pages, loads and loads of classified ads. Some of these classified ads in the back of alt weeklies were written in coded language, though it wasn't hard to decipher. They advertised sex work, some of it legal, some of it not. The editorial tone of these newspapers was skeptical, impolite, anti-establishment. Papers created in Lacey's own image.
Write a f***ing outline or I'll kill you. Said you just can't do 5,000 words off the top of your head. You got to put some sweat equity into this goddamn thing. No one's saying it's easy. Get off your ass and do it.
We realized something about Lacey. watching it first from afar and then up close as we interviewed him over the past 3 years. He's a larger-than-life presence, hounded by the government, who made fortunes as a public outlaw. Lacey is just the sort of character we would have killed to cover when we were working at New Times.
Trevor, Sam, and I worked at the Alt Weekly in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, north of Miami. Our jobs at New Times were kind of amazing. We lived in this beach town full of crazy people doing crazy things. Sometimes we'd report our stories, type up our drafts, then maybe go to the beach, share a joint, and read each other's work. New Times had a corporate culture that wasn't very corporate, at least not in ways any of us were accustomed to before then. I mean, it wasn't exactly sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but it wasn't that far off either. And somehow this culture at New Times Papers fostered some of the most interesting and important investigative reporting in America. New Times writers nationwide held local officials and agencies accountable and covered marginalized communities otherwise ignored by traditional media. Powerful people lived in fear that one day they'd get a call or a knock on the door from a New Times reporter. That was all part of the corporate culture too. Inside New Times offices around the country, reporters would talk about powerful people as if they were big game. Whose head could you mount on the wall?
I left New Times in 2006, 18 years ago now, a journalistic lifetime. For years, I didn't give New Times and its founder much thought. But then, something strange happened. In September 2016, a decade after I left the company, I received an email from a lawyer in Arizona asking for my mailing address. The email claimed Lacey was building a database of former employees. So I replied with my mailing address, figuring, what the hell? Maybe I'll get a holiday card. Then, a couple of weeks later, I got a check in the mail for $5,000. It was a gift from Lacey. Turns out Lacey, facing the possibility of serious federal charges and asset seizures, threw up a middle finger at the Justice Department. He became millions less rich by sending $5,000 checks to many of the journalists he'd once employed. Word quickly circulated among Lacey's former reporters.
Did you get a check?
What's Lacey up to?
Did you hear who didn't get a check?
The checks were so mysterious. No details. And lots of former employees didn't get one. Like me. It was classic Lacey. Showing real appreciation for his writers, while also drawing them into something that might be less than legal. Okay, let's go back in time to the age of the daily paper. Maybe you remember those bundles of dead trees thrown at your front door by a kid on a bicycle? For years, your hometown daily paper enjoyed a near monopoly on both news and advertising. Even a mediocre daily could turn 20%, 30% annual profits. So big corporations bought up American dailies and domesticated their newsrooms. The resulting papers were often bland by design, like the suburbs. If you reported for a daily and tested the limits of its inoffensive voice, an editor would remind you that this was a family paper. There were no drugs in the daily except when cops arrested people. There was no swearing in the daily, not even in a quote. The daily's outlook was, and is, more white, more heterosexual, more moneyed, and more little-c conservative than America at large.
To borrow a phrase from tech, the dailies were ripe for disruption. Alternative weekly newspapers arrived on the scene as that disruption. Alt-weekly newsrooms attracted a particular cast of journalists, culture writers who found dailies too staid, aspiring novelists and screenwriters who wanted to write nonfiction with bravado, hard news junkies who crawled the city like a tapeworm. More broadly, the alts got writers who, for one reason or another, chafed inside institutions. But the fact is, without an institution backing you, you can't get much done in journalism. We're in life. So the alts built robust papers around calling bull wherever they saw it. Along the way, they tried to enthrall or delight or enrage everyone in town.
If this sounds like a dream job to you, and if you could tolerate making less money than anyone else in your college graduating class, then congratulations. You might have had the makings of an alt-weekly journalist.
As a subspecies of alt-weekly, Lacey's New Times papers were also smart and weird and contrarian. But the papers we worked for also had certain other traits. For one, they were not as reliably left-leaning. For another, they were fiercely investigative. Even when covering, say, musicians or athletes, they went digging for dirt. They also had, in hindsight, a kind of cigar-chomping, testosterone-fueled bravado about them. Like a divorced uncle who insists you punch him in the gut as he flexes his abs and then buys you a shot.
So, 15 or 20 years ago, what made this dirtbag dream possible was the business side, how the operation made money. Now, as a reporter, usually, you don't really even want to know how the business works. You might even try to avoid seeing the ads that run next to your stories, because part of being as fair as possible means you want to treat everyone and every business equally. You don't want to know who's actually paying your salary. But at an all-weekly, it was really obvious. The paper was free, so it made money from advertising. Advertisers were restaurants, bars, national beer distributors, that type of thing. But, like the dailies, a lot of the advertising revenue came from the classifieds. Classified ads charged by the word. And you could fit a lot of words on a page of newsprint. A single page in the 80s or 90s might rake in more than $20,000 at a big weekly. And they could print page after page after page of those tiny ads in 10-point font. They were a huge moneymaker. You'd find classified ads in every kind of newspaper all over America for decades. People selling boats, or hiring bartenders, or renting apartments. Sometimes they were even personal ads, like a primitive form of dating apps. One person places an ad explaining what they're looking for. Single man seeks a lady who wants to travel the world. Married woman seeking a friend to visit art museums. New Times ran those, too, in the back pages of every issue. Boats for sale, apartments for rent, personals, all that. But all weeklies ran some slightly more, adult versions, too.
They had an entire section of the personals for escorts. They didn't explicitly advertise anything illegal, but everyone understood what they were selling. The company called it adult advertising.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how you define adult advertising.
That's Jim Larkin, Mike Lacey's business partner. Larkin ran the business side of the newspapers and later Backpage.com. He was arrested by the FBI the same day Lacey was.
I guess, advertising to meet people, meeting other people, massage, strippers, you know, those kinds of ads.
An ad in the back of a New Times paper might say something like M for M or M for W to indicate that a man is looking for a man or a man is looking for a woman. Innocuous enough.
Or an ad might feature an MWC seeking an SBF for an NSAONS. That would be a married white couple looking for a single black female for a no-strings-attached one-night stand.
If you saw a woman advertising a GFE, that's girlfriend experience, or any number of enticing massages at her place or at yours, well, that might be a consenting adult seeking another to exchange physical pleasure for U.S. dollars. Adult ads like these have always existed at the edge of First Amendment protection, because the language used was often ambiguous and the specific services offered for money a bit unclear. Publishers had a level of deniability that meant these ads were protected by free speech rights. The government couldn't prove these publishers knew the ads were advertising illegal services, so the ads were legal, protected by the First Amendment. Federal judges have ruled that if the government banned ambiguous ads, it would deprive rights from the people who aren't selling sex. In a gray zone, everyone gets to speak. So it was in the newspaper's interest to keep things hazy. But it was no secret that sex workers advertised in the back pages of all weeklies. We all just accepted this, including police and prosecutors. If the world's oldest profession advertised in the back pages of papers that you could find at bars and clubs, well then whatever.
That blind eye approach started to shift in the mid-90s. When Craig Newmark created a website that allowed people to post classified ads for free. He called it Craigslist. He charged car and furniture dealers and for help wanted in real estate ads. Everything else, whether you were selling your couch or renting out your bicycle, or leasing access to your body, that was all free. Craigslist, a homely, no-frills website, sucked the marrow out of American journalism. In 1995, newspaper classified ad revenue in the United States totaled about $12.5 billion. Craigslist cut a gaping hole in that money bag. So Mike Lacy and Jim Larkin started their own website to compete with Craigslist so they could maintain the classified ad business and keep part of that money.
We started in 2004 Backpage because we knew that the classified business was going away in newspapers. That's what we did.
Backpage.com. The new site looked a lot like Craigslist. It had the same categories, the same types of ads. Cars for sale, apartments for rent, job ads. It wasn't as big as Craigslist. Not even close, really. But it was growing.
And we were off to the races.
And just like the ads in the back pages of the papers, Backpage ran ads for escorts and for other sex workers. The ads even used many of the same thinly veiled codes as the classifieds in the back pages of the Alt Weeklies.
Our strength was adult. That's the way Backpage started.
Within a few years, Backpage was in every city in America, just like Craigslist. And wouldn't you know, Backpage was minting money while we were reporting in New Times papers. We may not have worked for Backpage, but as writers for Lacy and Larkin's newspapers, it helped cover our paychecks.
Ultimately, Backpage became a problem, a legal problem for Mike Lacy and Jim Larkin. For decades, police and politicians and moral crusaders tolerated the ads in the back of Alt Weeklies. Small protests popped up here and there. Police ran stings targeting sex workers and Johns now and again. But nobody clamored to shut down all these alternative newspapers nationwide. Backpage was different. As it grew to 30 million ads a year worldwide, the site started getting the attention of some very powerful people.
Backpage.com needs to shut itself down.
Before she was the vice president of the United States, before she was a U.S. senator, Kamala Harris was the attorney general of California. And back then, she took direct aim at Backpage.
When it has created as its business model the profiting off the selling of human beings and the purchase of human beings.
After Kamala Harris became a U.S. senator, she and other senators pushed an extraordinary bipartisan effort to pressure the Justice Department to go after Backpage. Lacy and Larkin were called to Capitol Hill to testify. The Justice Department came down on them with allegations that they were profiting from sex trafficking.
They don't scare me. You know, they just don't scare me. They've been after me for ever, okay? We were told this was legal, told repeatedly it was legal. We've had judges, federal judges, rule that it was legal. And now they still want to put us away? Well, take your best shot.
When Lacy was thrown in jail after that FBI raid, they told him he couldn't be in the general population for his own safety. So they took him to a solitary cell. In that cell, he found a book. The book was The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. Published in 1962, it's a celebrated Pulitzer Prize-winning history of the start of World War I. Turns out, it's a book that Lacy knows well. It's a book he used to hand out to his writers.
I'm sure the writers said, what the is he talking about? He flew all the way down here to tell us this kind of horseshit. Okay, what does this have to do with getting a story?
The Guns of August explains that Germany and France knew a war was inevitable. Both sides prepared to beat the other for decades. And both sides convinced themselves that they'd win. Germany had a massive army and the biggest guns the world had ever seen. France, meanwhile, was certain it could thwart a German invasion through its sheer Frenchness. France's plan was basically, come at me, bro.
Lacy randomly finding the Guns of August at his darkest moment sounded like a setup for a New Times story. A lucky detail that gestures toward this bigger truth.
We nudge Lacy to pick up the metaphor. Are you France or Germany?
I'm Belgium.
Okay.
Germany told neutral Belgium to lay down arms and let German forces pass through to France, or else. Instead, the Belgians swallowed hard and fought back. The Germans marched through anyway, pulverizing Belgium. An atrocity that galvanized other countries, including the US, to join the fight. That's what really got World War I going. Belgium's valiant stand against an unstoppable machine. So, in Lacey's read, he isn't France. We're France. You, me, and billions of people online. Everyone who uses Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Reddit. Politicians want more say over who can do what on the internet. They've proposed laws that would restrict what platforms and users can post. But clearly, the US government isn't throwing the book at, say, Mark Zuckerberg and Meta. That would mean confronting an army of lobbyists and lawyers, and a user base that includes a majority of Americans.
In Lacey's read, the government is hitting him instead. The smaller target, the would-be pushover. To Lacey, the Backpage case isn't really about Backpage, or prostitution, or sex trafficking, or the gray areas of advertising sex work. To him, the prosecution of Backpage is really about free speech online. The US government is aiming its unstoppable machine at the larger internet. And you know who's standing in the way? Mike Lacey. Whether or not you agree that Mike Lacey is a martyr, he is right about two things. He is absolutely outmatched. And yet, by fighting back anyway, he has the whole world watching.
Belgium, it didn't work out super well for Belgium. It
hasn't worked out super well for me.
Sam Eifling, Trevor Aronson, and Michael Mooney are the hosts of Hold Fast, a brand new 9-part series from Audible. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Eloise Blondio, Molly Rosen, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Candace Wong, with help from Sean Merchant. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Nerviano and Brendan Dalton. Katia Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Michael Lowinger.